Today on the Grave Talks, fact or fiction, a conversation with Joni Mahan. One afternoon, after taking part in a past life regression session, Joni Mahan noticed some strange scrolls on the wall of her psychologist friend's office. Out of curiosity, she asked, "What are the names on these scrolls?" The reply she got would blow her mind and send her on a journey seeking answers to one of the most horrific stories she would ever hear. The story of a cult, but not just any cult. A cult that would lock up their daughters, sacrifice babies, and eventually flee, never to be heard from again. Could this story possibly be real? Or was it the work of fiction laid out through the mind of a woman who suffered immeasurable abuse at the hands of her family? What was fact, and what was fiction?
Well, about 10 years ago, I went to get a past life reading from a woman who I knew was a hypnotherapist. And she was also a friend. She did dream readings and things like that. She was a psychic medium. And I got my past life regression. And afterwards, I noticed a couple of framed scrolls leaning against the wall. And I asked her if they were full of names. And I said, "What is that? What are those?" And she said, "Those are the names of all the children who died in the demonic cult." And then she started telling me the story, and it made my blood turn to ice.
I mean, you're sitting there. First of all, how did your reading go?
You know, it went really well. I had always wanted to have a past life regression, and I went in with one specific question. I wanted to know why I was so afraid of falling. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily heights. It was that sensation in your chest as you fall, like on a roller coaster or when you trip and fall. I will do anything to avoid experiencing that. And so she led me through the past life regression, and I learned that I was a man in that life. It was the Wild West, and I was hung. So the feeling of falling comes from that sensation of the trap door falling mm-hmm. and me plunging to my death.
Interesting. I mean, when you got that information, how did you process it? Did it make sense to you? Was it what was going through your mind?
Well, it definitely resonated with me. I think if anything, it made me realize that it was probably accurate, because if I had gone into the reading and tried to manipulate it or come up with some conclusion of my own making, mm-hmm. I would have thought I would have fallen out of a window or fallen off a cliff. I would never have guessed that. So seeing it so real and so vivid in my mind really did make me believe it was real.
Sure. So you have this reading, you kind of get this, you know, this very interesting piece of information about yourself, about past lives and things like that. And then she says to you, "Oh, those are the children who died in the demonic cult. Their names are on those scrolls over there." What on earth is going through your mind at that moment?
I had no idea. Yeah. Of course, I was curious, because sure. That's just my nature. So I asked her, I said, "What demonic cult? How do you yeah. have these scrolls?" Yeah. And she proceeded to tell me the story. So she had been treating a woman for many years who had survived that cult. And I'm not going to name her. I don't name her in the book. We call her Reese, because that was her nickname. She's passed now, but her family still lives, and we don't want anything coming back to any of her, you know, relatives. Sure. But she had been so traumatized and so damaged during this experience that she had multiple personalities, and she was never able to really live on her own. Mm-hmm. And the therapist, her name is Marianne, she told me that Reese had actually lived with her for a few years. She started off as a client and treated her for years, and then they became friends during the process, and she just had a huge love for this woman and for her strength for enduring something like that, and lived with her until she was no longer able to care for her. And then Reese went into a nursing home, and that's where she passed away, probably about 7 or 8 years ago.
So what was the story of the cult? What was going on, you know, that leads us to the scroll of these children? What did she find out about the cult? You know, let's start at the beginning there.
Well, it was really creepy in the fact that it happened right in plain sight. So there was a small town set up in Rhode Island. In my book, I changed the location to West Virginia, mm-hmm. but this happened in Rhode Island back in the 1950s. And this group set up their own little town and or an offset from another town, but they lived completely in their own world there. And every single member of the town was involved in this demonic cult. Mm-hmm. And they even had a church in the middle of this small town. And in the church, they would have regular services on Sunday. And Reese's mother taught Sunday school. But by night, the church was used for a very different purpose. That's where they used it for the demonic practices. So, you know, and it's so crazy thinking that something like this could happen. And I tried to track back any records of, you know, news articles or anything like that to substantiate it. Not that I didn't believe what I heard, because the stories were so detailed that I don't think anybody could have made this up. And we actually found one little piece of evidence. Reese remembers that they had a flag. And in the middle of the flag is a Nazi swastika. Mm-hmm. And she said that they had Nazi ties and possibly also mob ties. And when I was researching for my book, I relied heavily on my friend Tracy Hain, who did a lot of research for me. She actually located a picture of that flag, and it was from the right area, and it had the swastika on the middle of it. So it was a little bit of validation for me that, you know, I wasn't chasing a wild goose.
So this is something that really was completely in plain sight. So if you were to be in this area of Connecticut at the time, you would think, if you don't go to that church, it's a church. Okay, it's a church. But I'm assuming a fairly closed off church to new members. Would that be correct? I mean, if they're doing this sort of stuff at night, was this like the entire congregation that's involved in this? Or is this just kind of like a select few that come out that, you know, they're having the men's night or the women's night or whatever night? But if you're not part of that group, you're not going to the church that night. And it turns out they're doing satanic rituals.
Right. I think that was probably what it was. I think the church was really more of a cover for what they were doing, which mm-hmm. kind of sounds ludicrous, but that's what it was.
I don't know how ludicrous that is. There's plenty of churches that have been covers for horrible things in the past.
Well, that is true.
it's usually like, you know, other horrible things, not satanic cults. Just shocking. So, I mean, tell me more about what you learned. What was going on here with this church and the cult activity of it?
Well, they worshiped Lucifer, and they frequently did sacrifices for him. And in the beginning, I believe animals were used for the sacrifices, but then they got to a point where they thought, you know, we need something bigger, something more powerful, because we're not invoking Lucifer. He's not coming through. And the leader of this group would hear words in his head that he said were the voice of Lucifer telling him what he needed to do. So they took their daughters, every one of the members of this cult, their daughters become breeders. And they would start off by teaching them how to be compliant and passive so that they would be more willing to go along with whatever they wanted them to do. And they had huge cages that they kept in the woods in between the houses back, you know, where nobody could see them from the road. And they would start off with minor infractions. You know, if the girl spoke back to her parents, she was put in the cage for a couple days. Sometimes she was given food and water. Sometimes she wasn't. Sometimes she was given clothes, and sometimes she wasn't. And then the infractions started getting more severe until they got them to a point where they were just completely submissive. And then they began having rituals where they would meet, and every male member of this congregation would literally rape these girls. And this happened monthly until they would get pregnant. And then they would become breeders for, you know, for the satanic cult. And once their babies were born, they were whisked away and they were sacrificed within 24 hours of the birth because they felt it was more powerful. And the girls were never part, they never, the girls never got to see the ritual or the sacrifices, which is really good, but they would get a glimpse of the baby before it was whisked away. And then it would start all over again. So Reese ended up having two children during this process. She said the first one was fathered by her own father. And the second one she didn't know because it was so many people involved. So just something that horrific and mind-numbing. And they did other things to the girls, too, that I did not put in the books because it was just too graphic. And frankly, it just made my stomach turn thinking about it.
Let me ask you this. What was the motivation of this cult? I mean, there's usually something that motivates a cult to act in certain ways. I mean, this, I mean, it seems, you know, extreme. It seems, you know, just so out there as to why, you know, why would these group of men, I'm assuming, you know, it's men involved in doing these things to these women, decide one day, you know, we should do this cult, we should worship Satan, and then cage our daughters, and then have them reproduce, and then kill our grandchildren, essentially. What's going on there? I mean, what is the motivation here?
I know.
What's the logic of any of this?
It's awful. It's terrible. From what I know, their motivation was power and money, which is usually the motivation in a lot of wrongdoings in the world. Mm-hmm. But they were hoping to invoke Satan, that they would live forever. They would have power. They would have money. They could, you know, rule the world, basically. So I don't know that they ever invoked Satan. But, you know, if they did, that area is very saturated with negative energy.
Who are these men? Were they powerful people? Were they just your average, you know, blue collar, white collar? Do you have any information? I know we don't have names or anything like that, but were they, you know, of what sort of ilk were they of?
Well, she said they were all walks of life, everything mm-hmm. from laborers to doctors to lawyers. They were just a group of people that had the same reasoning, and they followed this crazy leader. And I think, you know, if you look through history, you know, there've been a lot of cults mm-hmm. and it usually revolves around one person who is very personable, someone who's very convincing. And, you know, perhaps he showed them some examples of what they could have or what would happen to them if they followed him. And they just one by one began coming into his group. So, and they started believing him and following everything he did and everything he wanted them to do.
Now, I'm assuming this wasn't like the single dad's club where it's just, you know, there's no mom in the picture in all of these situations. Where's mom for these girls?
They were involved. They knew about it. They were right there with it. You know, they were part of the cult as well, which is really, as a mother, it's really hard for me to latch on to that idea of allowing someone to take my child and do horrific things to it and then turn around and kill my grandchild. So
yeah,
this whole group, they drank the Kool-Aid. That's all I can say. They were very embedded in the belief that this was what they needed to do.
I mean, it seems like, I mean, if true, this would be one of like the worst cults of all time. I mean, in at least in the United States, to, you know, hear about these sort of things. I mean, how, so the person, what was her name that the nickname that we're talking about with her?
Reese.
So Reese, when she talked to the therapist or the psychologist, I mean, how did this come about? Had she been getting help throughout her life? Did she just, you know, someone said you should go here? Did she seek it out herself? How did she end up starting to tell these stories?
I think she was referred to Mary Ann at an early age. I feel like Mary Ann saw her for most of her life. So she was probably not, she was probably just out on her own as a young adult and realized that she couldn't function in the world. And that's when she sought out help and someone told her about Mary Ann. So I think they connected up pretty early.
How did she go about sharing these stories? I mean, was this ever looked into? I would think, I mean, number one, a psychologist would have the duty of, if someone is saying this went down, of reporting it.
Yeah, I know. And some of this is very shady, or not shady, but very cloaked in silence, because I think there was also an apprehension by Reese to bring this to light. She didn't want to bring shame on her family, even mm-hmm. though her family brought shame on her. So Mary Ann respected her wishes. She looked into it. She had information. She knew a lot about it, but they got away was what happened. They were scattered to off four corners of the United States. So they managed to, they were found out and exploited, and they managed to get away. And some of that might be the mob ties. I don't know. Some of it, I really don't know the information, and it's been so long ago for Mary Ann, she doesn't remember all the details. And some of it she just wouldn't give me. Like, I wanted the name of the town, mm-hmm. and she was very elusive. She said, oh, I can't remember. And I'm pretty sure she did remember. But, you know, there's still that desire to honor Reese's memory and not bring it to light too much. I mean, she knows I wrote this book, and I interviewed her for it again recently as I was writing it. But, you know, they don't really want that information out there in a way that could be tracked back to Reese.
The information that was given, as far as especially where they were tracked down, they were exposed and then scattered. What is the story on that? Like, what is the deeper story on how that went down?
One of the girls, and it was in my book, I call her Abigail, and I have her featured as a ghost that shows up on this property. But in real life, she was one that was just a little bit more, less submissive. And she realized this was wrong, and she kept trying to escape. And they kept putting her back in the cages, and she'd spent weeks there sometimes. And one day she had an opportunity. Somebody drove up in a car. And I think they had a gas station there or something. And she put a note on the window of the door on the car when nobody was looking. And it said, please help me. They won't let me leave, and they keep killing my babies. And nobody saw her leave the note. But the person that owned the car saw it, and they took it right to the police. And I guess people were tipped off before the police could get there, because the town was empty by the time law enforcement arrived. So, and this is back in the 50s, so it was easier for them to escape than it would be today. Today we'd have them, you know, we'd know where they were immediately. But, you know, there was, and you know, you have to understand, wealth and power and money makes things go away pretty easily. So I don't know if they had connections or what happened. I know that some of them relocated to Florida. That was all she really told me about where they went. And Reese's family ended up in Florida as well for a while. And then Reese ended up moving back to the Rhode Island area years afterwards.
So did Reese cut ties with her family essentially and start her own, or what happened with her? How did she get out of this?
Well, I believe she cut ties with everybody but her brother. But her brother was a younger brother, so he wasn't aware of anything that was going on during the time. And I don't know that he ever learned the truth about what was happening. But as she got older, she just really cut ties with everybody. There was nobody that she was connected to besides her therapist and, you know, that with friendship.
How did it come about that these scrolls with children's names on came into the possession of the psychologist?
Well, Reese wrote them down. She wrote them down while she still remembered them. It was all the children that had died during that 10-year period that the demonic cult was active. And some of it was names of babies. The mothers named their babies, even though they were sacrificed. So it was all the names that she could remember, and she wrote them down. And to honor her memory and to honor her experience, Marianne had them framed, had scrolls made and had them framed. And she didn't really hang them up on the wall where you could see them. They were kind of leaning against a wall, maybe behind, you know, a plant or something. They weren't real easy to see. Mm-hmm. But I think for Marianne, it was a memory. It was something to remind her of everything that Reese went through and their time together.
I mean, it sounds like such an extreme story. Gentlemen, what's your reaction to this? I mean, you hear this story, and you're just inquiring initially about those scrolls with those names on it. What is going through your mind? Are you believing this story right away? Are you, you know, this is obviously a very fantastical story. How are you processing all of this as it's being told to you?
Well, you know, I'll preface this by saying I'm normally a very skeptical person. You know, I'm a paranormal investigator, and I will research everything until I come to a conclusion. But the details in these stories and the information and just Marianne herself, she's not one prone to, you know, telling fantastical tales that aren't accurate.
Yeah.
And I never met Reese, but I did talk to her on the phone. When I met Marianne, Reese was already in a nursing home. Mm-hmm. And I did get to talk to her on the phone at one point. And, you know, she sounded exactly like I had expected. I saw pictures of her. I saw pictures of her with Marianne. So I know that she really did exist. You know, and there was a part of me that wondered at one point, you know, the satanic panic of the, you know, 1980s. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were having past life regressions and coming back and saying that they were, you know, molested or something by a satanic cult. And those memories turned out to not be accurate. But I think her details and the things that happened and, you know, the people that were involved, and it was just too detailed to not be true. And, you know, the source mattered to me too. I'd trust Marianne not to be telling me a story. And, you know, why would she have these scrolls made up if that wasn't the, you know, the story behind it? So, you know, I will tell you, I don't 100% know that this really happened. I can't tell you that. I can tell you we found that flag that Reese drew a picture of, and it was very similar, but I can't tell you 100% true that this happened. But I was horrified when I heard about it, because it really scared me that something like this could have happened, like in my parents' era. You know, my mother was a little girl growing up in the 1950s. And, you know, it depends on where you live and who your parents are, how you're going to be treated. And the thought that something like this could have happened to somebody I know, you know, it was pretty mind numbing, the whole story.
It really is. I mean, it's one of those where you certainly want to try and find out more information on, just to factually, you know, check this, to try and find some way. The flag was found, and I believe that this woman existed, that Marianne had this person as a client. I guess my hesitation on the fantasticalness of it is this woman did seem to have other mental problems going on, which then could be attributed to, you know, an upbringing in that sort of environment. That does add up. That does make sense. But it's just the being protective of the family, being protective of where this happened. That's where it would be great to have more information. And I really wonder if there's anyone else out there that hears this that would be like, I have a similar story, or there's, you know, it puts some pieces together of little blocks that maybe they've heard from a loved one or a friend or a family member or something along the line that seemed fairly fantastical, but, you know, it just kind of was brushed off or was too dark to talk about.
Yeah, I would love that. I really hope that that happens so that I can learn more about this because, you know, I'm taking the word from one person who is conveying a secondhand story to me. And I do believe it happened, you know, with all my skepticism laced in there. I really think this truly happened. And, you know, through my research, you know, I learned a lot that, you know, things like this did happen, maybe not so publicly, but, you know, there were little branches everywhere. And this was, I was very careful to separate the demon worship from Satanism, because the Satanism group, they're very organized, but they did not get organized until, I believe it was like the 1960s, I want to say 63, 64. So this happened well before the Satanists become an organization and had their own scrolls and their own ideals. But, and, you know, if you read their laws, one of them is that you will never harm children. So the Satanism group and the demon worshiping group are two different things. And I wanted to be very careful to point that out during the book, because I, you know, I don't want the Satanists to get angry.
You don't want to offend the Satanists. it's always important we don't offend the Satanists. The details of this story, where you said you had done some research and discovered that there were other groups like this out there. Tell me about that. What were you discovering?
You know, it's hard to, nothing real specific, just a lot of little blurbs here and there that, you know, demon worship was happening all around the United States during this period. It was probably smaller groups, not whole towns. But one thing I did uncover, and, you know, I'm not sure if this group practiced this or not, but in mythology, Lucifer, was the son of Venus, and, you know, the planet Venus. Venus was a goddess. And in my book, we came into some really fascinating stuff. Like, if they were worshiping Lucifer and they wanted to pay respect to him, then they would do everything that they could to try to get Lucifer's attention. Uh-huh. And so they would have their practices on dates when Venus was closest to Earth, and those are called Venus perigee days. So Venus, in an 8-year period, comes closer to Earth, and it comes closer to Earth 5 times in an 8-year period. And what's really interesting is that it makes the sign of the pentagram in the sky. So if you looked at every time it came close, it zips in and zips out. So in my book, I decided that every Venus perigee day, when it comes closest to Earth, was when they would do a sacrifice. And then the major sacrifice would happen during the Venus pentagram day. So I don't know. I don't know if they did that. You know, I did find that some groups did honor that. I don't know if that group, that's where fiction crosses over into reality. Uh-huh. But I just thought it was very fascinating.
Is there any, did she have any insight as to, you know, I hate to say the word, but it's like, the success of the group, you know, where they, you know, they're doing these absolutely horrific things with some sort of intent, be it money, be it power. I mean, what kept them going? What kept them going and saying, yeah, this is a great idea. Let's keep going to the Sunday night baby sacrifice.
Yeah, that's a funny way to put it. Well, I think they might have had small successes. They would do a sacrifice and then one of them would get a promotion or someone would come into money. So they would just attribute it back to, oh, it must have worked. So we need to do this again. And it just kept going. I mean, you know, all it takes is one really crazy person who is able to convince a group of people to follow their ways. And they do all kinds of insane things. I mean, you can look at cults through history and you can see similar behavior, maybe not sacrificing babies, but this is what they believed. And, you know, they were, a lot of them were raised in this cult. Like the boys were groomed from an early age to take over for their fathers. And so it was, that was how life was for them. Now, this is just what they did.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Joni Mahan. As we continue to dive into the story of fact or fiction, what are other possible explanations for such an extreme story of the torment of a child in a cult? Does Joni believe that the story of sacrifice was real? What could possibly drive a group of people to act in such horrific ways? And was the story more of a coping mechanism for abuse and not an actual factual event? We'll dive into the psychology of this account in part two. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.